Well, my sermon may be a little shorter today. That was such a good introduction. It saved me from spending the usual 10 minutes or so talking about religious liberty. But I hope that you remember that our church does publish Liberty Magazine and has since 1906, and before that under a couple of other names, the Sentinel and the variant on it. The Religious Liberty Sentinel, it published a Religious Liberty Journal right back to its very beginnings. A.T. Jones was the hero of the hour, as far as I'm concerned, and I might mention him later. But, you know, it only continues, and it's only effective as our church members support what we're doing with Religious Liberty. And next January, you get your chance to show that you do believe in it. You know, I'm sometimes of a cynical turn of mind, and I wonder sometimes, a church that's so consistently distributed a magazine like Liberty, that's consistently read and understood, of course not always appreciated because we have a different view than some people, but it's communicating our views to legislators, thought leaders, mayors, lawyers, and so on. You know, a magazine that's doing that on a biblically based Adventist position, there's always the danger that it might be out of sync with Seventh Adventists themselves really believe, you in the pew. So you have to read the magazine to find out, is this my view? And if not, why not? You know, you can attack me and those that prepare it, or you might look more closely at your view. We're in the middle of an election campaign at the moment, and far be it from me and our church to comment specifically on that. But, you know, it's very obvious that religion as usual is in play. It's very obvious that many Seventh-day Adventists have a reflex position that supports some of the more extremist views on religious liberty or religious entitlement as it's become. And so again, think about these things. Think about what it means to you, and if it means anything at all, it's time to put your means toward it. I want to start off by telling you a story keyed to the title of the sermon. I'm always being asked for a sermon title before I've really thought deeply about what I'm going to say. And the title I gave was White Horse Time, and I like to put double meanings into titles. And I didn't realize it might mean Lincoln Steed is here. You know, Steed is a horse. The white horse is here. But I mean something far more biblical, as you can tell from the reading a little bit earlier from Revelation. But the story I want to tell you took place, and I experienced it a few years ago when the world was young, or at least when the U.S. was young. We've aged a lot in the last 15, 16 years. As you know, we're not the same country. And about that time, with Dr. John Gratz, he and I traveled. He was the then head of the Religious Liberty Department for the General Conference. We traveled halfway across the world and more, even though it was close to my neck of the woods as an Australian, halfway across the world to Indonesia, and 4 hours flight time from Jakarta, the capital, eastward to their province of Maluku and the capital city there of Ambon. And the reason we went was because we had heard in Washington hearings and information publicly shared in a congressional situation about religious civil war. Indonesia is a majority, in fact an overwhelming majority Muslim country, about 95%, but in the province of Maluku, where Ambon City is, a city of about 200,000 people, it was 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. And with Al-Qaeda's help, in quotes, civil war had broken out between the Christians, supported by the local police who had given them weapons, then the military, overwhelmingly Muslim, had come in and given their weapons to the Muslims. So it was an armed civil war where, by the time we arrived, even though it was a ceasefire of sorts, it was off bounds for tourists and journalists, but they didn't know I was a journalist. And 10, 15,000 had been killed, and a high percentage of the population had fled. And the city was almost a ghost town. And some of you may have heard me comment on it before, but I've never seen anything like it. short of going to the Middle East or somewhere where there's so much devastation, nobody can live in a city where we saw an ember, maybe 25-30% of everything burned and abandoned. And I don't want to tell you all the things that happened there. It was an amazing experience, an amazing experience. We were there partly to see how Christians, how Seventh-day Adventists related to this violence. Unfortunately, we saw evidence that many Christians, some Seventh-day Adventists, were caught up in the violence themselves. When we met with the Adventist church in the middle of the week, I noticed the bullet holes in the walls, bullet holes through the lectern. And I asked the head elder, "You think the violence will happen again?" "Oh, yes," he said, "but I'm ready. I have my gun." Not good. But I want to end by telling you a very uplifting story after all of this trauma and the shock even that we had in seeing what it was like and how many Christians, how many Adventists, some ran. Many of the administrators were not there when we arrived, and others became part of the problem. But over it all, I know God had his hand on it. And on three occasions, Muslim gangs, murder gangs, tried to storm our mission headquarters there that was around the bay, about 20, 30 miles from the city and very close to the airport. But it was a killing zone across the street from the mission compound was a Muslim village that was totally burned and flattened. Didn't exist anymore when we came. Many people died there. And on a number of occasions, our workers sheltered Muslims fleeing from Christian mobs. But on three occasions, the Muslim mobs came at night to kill every Adventist. The compound had the small administrative offices. There were a number of workers' homes. There was a half-finished church off to one side to the right, fairly close to the road. And there was a school behind, some woods behind it, but no fence, just a slight little garden, mini hedge, maybe 18 inches high at the highest along the street. The first night the gang came, they were ready to make a quick end of it because the usual plan was they would come in, throw fire onto the roof, set the house on fire, and as the people ran out, kill them. And they were ready to do that. But as they surged across that little garden barrier, they looked off to the side before they'd lit anything, and there in the unfinished church was an unearthly supernatural fire or a glow. And they were so frightened that they fled back to some of the Muslim suburbs and spread the word. And the next morning, it filtered back to the Adventist community. But of course, that wasn't going to stop them. So a few nights later, they came back. And in the dark, gang of thugs, and I saw many of them on the plane that we flew in, by the way. I got more and more uncomfortable on the 737 heading into this war zone, and I didn't know at first what it was, but after a while I looked around, I realized no women on the plane, and all of the men in their late teens, early 20s, tough guys. And these were the sort of guys that were going to storm the Adventist compound for the second time. And in the dark, as they came up to that garden barrier on the street, they bumped into a wall. Not a Trumpian wall, but an invisible spiritual wall. They couldn't get through. And because that didn't stop them initially, so they hoisted a few guys up on the shoulders to reach the top, to clamber over. Couldn't reach the top. So in the dark, they felt around to find a gate or an end to the wall, and they went all the way around that property, probably a 30, 40-acre property. No entry. So frustrated, they went back to the Muslim areas and told the story the next day that filtered back. God had protected them. But they came a third time, more determined than ever, to really let some blood, get rid of some Christians. And on this occasion, they were horrified, startled, and intimidated by what they saw, because not so moonless as the night before. But as they came up to the property, there in an unbroken line, on the front of the property, shoulder to shoulder, were tall, white robed soldiers. And that scared them. Who were these soldiers? And what they remarked on, as they told the story back in the community, was their leader. He was seated on a large white horse. And it wasn't just that he was this apparently supernatural leader, but what they commented on was his the way he was seated on the horse. It wasn't a saddle. It was like a throne sitting up on the horse, and he was sitting on top of that. An amazing story. When they told that to us, it pretty much redeemed all of the other bad parts of the story. It didn't remove them, but it told me that God was there. Not just figuratively, but literally. And even at my most cynical, let's just imagine that this was a manufactured story from those gangs and those toughs. Even then it speaks so well of God's protection, but I don't believe that's even likely. But it is certain that in that war and that conflict, as in most of them, alcohol and drugs and mind manipulation play a large role. So you have to at least think about that. The man on the white horse. There's no question that in our present situation in the United States at the moment, people are looking for a man on the white horse. But they're not always looking for a spiritual leader. They're ready for someone that'll march in as a conqueror. I did a little investigation just to double check my remembrance last night. And almost every religious and political scenario has a place for the man on the white horse. You know, starting with Islam. You know, Barak is the name of Muhammad's horse that he supposedly rode in the night journey as he journeyed over to Jerusalem. That's the claim on Jerusalem, the Islamic claim. But it's a dream. But in the dream, he rode this heavenly horse that the angel Gabriel gave to him. And then they also stopped off in heaven where he had a little dialogue with God. And Muslims should be very thankful to Muhammad because he took God out of 50 prayers a day, a little bit like Abraham with God, on how many people it would take to save Sodom and Gomorrah. Got it down to 5 prayers a day. That was at the suggestion of Moses. You should read some of this stuff. Very interesting. But, you know, in ancient Rome, the Caesars typically would ride on a white horse as they came in triumph into Rome. In the Bhagavad Gita and Indian religious epics, again, there is a place for the white horse. And of course, in Revelation, we read there that Jesus is clearly identified as coming on a white horse as a conqueror. Now, I had to go through that section in Revelation chapter 19, but what I want to pick up on is probably the more known segment in Revelation chapter 6, because there is a sequence of horses there. First, there's the white horse. I don't want to read it all, but just look at it briefly and think of what's being told. It says, the Lamb opened the 7 seals, and the first seal was a white horse, and a rider with a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. And I double-check so I don't speak heresy, but you know, Ellen White and Adventist commentators typically see this as applying to the church, and of course an image of Christ and the truth of the Christian message. But there's different ways this has been looked at. It's been looked at a history starting with the white horse, then the red horse, then the black horse, and then the pale horse. It's been seen as a history of Rome, as it clearly could be. It's been seen as a history of the Christian church and its powerful beginning with the Word of God and the Spirit of Christ, and then its declension into a persecuting, decrepit power in the Dark Ages. It could be that. I noticed that Billy Graham was even inclined to see the white horse as the Antichrist. I'm not really sure I'm ready to go with that one, but the figure is very apropos. And we indeed are living in a time when horse riders, powerful figures, can be expected to appear. And none of us know, again, what will happen on this election. But I'm only mentioning it because it's suggested for the first time in the last several decades that there are forces that could easily be harnessed toward a dangerous end, even in this Western democracy. And regardless of how this election turns out, those forces are growing and they are predicted. And if you've paid any attention to religious liberty, you know that liberty, civil liberty and religious liberty cannot be taken for granted anymore. And in fact, the way I put it is, by and large, what we're dealing with in the United States today is religious entitlement. You know, we've got a Supreme Court action where the owners of a certain chain that you see all the time, they were given the right to deprive other people of their right to make a choice on something that may have a moral component. That's not religious liberty in my view. The test that you can apply always on religious liberty, if there is coercion involved, it's not liberty. And in fact, the very understanding of liberty is drifting. And, you know, can you blame your fellow citizens? Can you blame people in the Western world? We're assaulted on every front by real threats, violence, religious violence. We're threatened with economic collapse. It will happen soon, but we all ignore it, presuming that if we ignore it, like on a plane, I travel a lot, and I've learned finally, and I've gone through a phase where I used to die 1,000 deaths during the bad weather, and here all relaxed fellow flyers, I realize now they're as probably as frightened as me, but most people have the ability to shut it out and to figure, if I'm asleep, if I will it away, it doesn't exist. And it does exist. We are on the edge of the cataclysm. The horsemen are already saddling up. You and I, as Seventh-day Adventists, we know that these final rapid events are to work through. There's a song that I heard a while ago, and I just loved it. It says, when you see the storm is coming, see the lightning part the stars, what you do is remember, hold on, child, hold on to what you know is true, hold on till you get through, hold on, hold on, the night will soon be by, child, hold on, there's angels on the way. And I note in that first reading we had of the later reference to the white rider in Revelation, the angels are on white horses too. And I don't know if they ride galloping steeds. You know, I haven't done much galloping, so, but you know, a steed is the image of war and power in the old world. I don't know whether they're flying saucers or whether they're strap-on wings, as Ellen White at one point seems to imply with the little kids in the new world, we don't know. But the forces of heaven have to be seen as real, and I believe that they're ready to come to our help. But we need to wake up, open the window, and face the situation and don't ignore it anymore. And particularly when we're talking about religious liberty, know that something is about to happen. In great controversy, which I used to think all Adventists know, but I've come to believe, even in some of the groups that I meet with at our world headquarters, they haven't read it, if at all, not recently. And in the chapter, The Impending Conflict, Ellen White says this, and it resonates with me, as I think that at the moment there's a storm skimming up the coast. If it shifts 1 or 2 degrees, it'll be like Sandy of several years ago, that in itself, today, I believe, would precipitate rather unhappy events in our civic life in this country. She says, Satan works through the elements also to garner his harvest of unprepared souls. He has studied the secrets of the laboratories of nature, and he uses all his power to control the elements as far as God allows. When he was suffered to afflict Job, how quickly flocks and herds, servants, houses, children were swept away, one trouble succeeding another as in a moment. It is God that shields his creatures and hedges them in from the power of the destroyer. But the Christian world have shown contempt for the law of Jehovah. And the Lord will do just what he has declared that he would. He will withdraw his blessing from the earth and remove his protecting care from those who are rebelling against his law and teaching and forcing others to do the same. Satan has control of all whom God does not especially guard. He will favor and prosper some in order to further his own designs, and he will bring trouble upon others and lead men to believe that God is afflicting them. I've thought of this a lot in relation to the proposed Sunday sacredness that is alive and well in this country. When you talk religious liberty for Seventh-day Adventists, people and Sunday laws, people tend to go back to 1888 and A.T. Jones, because that was indeed a time when an incipient Sunday law was upon us. It was defeated. And people think, well, it was defeated because it could never have passed. I don't think so. Ellen White was in full expectation, as A.T. Jones, that this was the moment. This was the culmination. That was why A.T. Jones was so impelled to present a revival or a logic of revival, because how else could God's people prepare for this great test on the day of worship unless they were spiritually prepared? I mean, it's bad enough not to be in possession of the knowledge of what's going on, but even in full knowledge of what's happening, you won't stand unless you're spiritually prepared. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard the language of it, but you know, I've got part of the bill, the cogent part, the relevant part. This is what was introduced in May 21, 1888, not just something that popped up on the legislative agenda. You must understand, and a lot of Adventists get freaked out all the time because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of laws that bubble and boil on the fringes of the legislatures. Some of them are put there just to satisfy some backer, others to make a point. Often they know they're going nowhere. But this bill, the Blair bill, had the full support of most of the religionists in the United States at the time, most of the organizations like the WCTU, weak as it may be today. It was one of the most powerful social organizations that, of course, directly led, and Ellen White was involved with this, to the Prohibition Amendment a little later. And this is what it said. It was, as it came through the Committee on Education and Labor, a bill to secure to the people the enjoyment of the first day of the week, commonly known as the Lord's Day, as a day of rest, and to promote its observance as a day of religious worship. Plain enough. And I'll read just one more paragraph. It says, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that no person or corporation or the agent, servant or employee of any person or corporation shall perform or authorize to be performed any secular work, labor or business to the disturbance of others, and then it says works of necessity, mercy and humanity excepted, nor shall any person engage in any play, game or amusement or recreation to the disturbance of others on the first day of the week, commonly known as the Lord's Day, or during any part thereof in any territory whatever of the United States. The other day I had Adventists sit in my office and take me to task for using an allusion once in an editorial where I spoke about the American Taliban. Remember what the Taliban tried to do, or did, in Afghanistan? Stop kite flying. What does this say here? Nor shall any person engage in any play, game, or amusement. It's the same in the name of religion. There were and still are people that will squeeze you down to do in every particular as their narrow vision of following God implies. And as the different horsemen that prance across the verses of Revelation are interpreted, at different times the church used every force, persecution of every type of bloodletting to force people to obey a perverted form of religion. I missed the most important part of the seals, because after the pale horse, the fifth seal, it says, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they'd borne. This is figurative. We don't believe there's living souls of dead people up in heaven. But it says they cried out with a loud voice, "Oh, sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long wilt thou judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell upon the earth?" That's what we need to understand. There's a force waiting to come. It's not perfectly okay. Just because the windows are down on our sensibility doesn't mean the wings aren't about to come off. I truly believe that we're at a day of great danger for Bible truth and for religious freedom. The world also is more dangerous. You know, I'm told all the time I'm a baby boomer. I was born right after World War II, and that's all I've known. It's only through history books and others that I read about what happened in World War II. But I remember, as a very young person, I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember John F. Kennedy's assassination, and even in far-off Australia, that shook everybody's sensibility. I remember what I recently read about the near miss in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just two things in a book I read recently tells me that it was God's hand that protected us from nuclear obliteration, not man's caution. A Soviet submarine never got the word about the U.S. embargo or naval blockade. And when they came under depth charge attack off the U.S. coast, the submarine commander gave the order, let loose the nuclear missiles. That was the standing order. And a couple of his crew, a couple of officers objected, got into a big argument, guns were even drawn. Basically, they had a mutiny, and in the end, the captain agreed. Before releasing them, they would surface and look around. They surfaced in the middle of a surrounding group of U.S. Navy missiles with the sailors laughing at them. Not a funny matter. Then, on the other side of the world, a U-2 strayed into Soviet space. And, of course, the Russian fighters scrambled to shoot it down. And American fighters, I think from the Aleutians, were scrambled to intercept them. And I read the story about one of the fighter pilots. He said it was rather ominous. The only weapons they had since they were on nuclear alert were nuclear-tipped missiles. They never found the Russians. If they had, it would have been on. And today, we are in the same spot. You know, it's not for us to know or influence. You know, we're just observers of all of this. But I don't understand why the news has been kept from us. A couple of days ago, 40 million Russians sheltered in their air raid shelters. They've been told by Putin to expect nuclear war. It's the biggest confrontation I ever remember. And you know, and God's in control. I doubt mankind is about to totally obliterate itself. But wars and rumors of wars are promised. But in their aftermath comes severe restriction on liberties. Severe restrictions on life as we know it. Everything is in hazard. And the Constitution is a wonderful document. But if you know anything about the U.S. Constitution and the way of governance in the U.S. as well as all other Western countries, all bets are off in emergencies. And in a time of stress, civil liberties and religious liberty probably won't survive. There's a document that I've shared before with Adventists who seem not to have been troubled to read it, that just over a year ago, the present Pope of Rome disseminated to the whole world, called Laudato Si, Praise be to Thee. It's an environmental document. And like the health message, we're about to find out that we were sleeping. And a march has been stolen on us. We once had a uniquely applicable and exportable health message. But, you know, you go down especially in California, you go down streets and there's all sorts of health shops and health programs. Good job. You know, that's good in its own level. But we haven't been able effectively to harness that to our proclamation of the soon return of Christ for quite a while. We should have been speaking of the seventh day in conjunction with the environment and custody of this earth. It's now been stolen from us. And the document is very interesting. I should mention, it followed on the heels of a document by his predecessor called Caritas et Veritatis, charity and truth, whereby in 2008, in a document that was given to the new US president as he went to the first meeting of the G8 after the economic collapse, and it addressed every issue of the modern world, the matters of national sovereignty, which, if you know your history, only date from the Reformation. After the 30 years wars that followed the Reformation, then in a treaty, the modern nation state was established. It's under threat at the moment. That was addressed in the document. Capital and labor issues were addressed. Economic collapse was addressed. All of these things. One of the magazines that I read said of the document, very good document. The magazine was not a religious one, by the way. It said it's a good prescription for what ails the world. But he says the trouble is, you accept this document, the Pope comes with it. And in that document it said that there is a need for a global authority with the power to act and the power to enforce. But you didn't need to read that. You've been reading Great Controversy. You know what it says there. You know what happened in the Middle Ages. And so this Laudato Si, that was the document issued early last year and the document that lay behind the man in white who appeared before our legislators in September 24 last year. That document is a Sabbath document, an environmental document that bases its whole logic on the Sabbath. Let me share a couple of quotes with you. And I know you haven't read it by and large because I've done the rounds in the building I work in, they haven't read it either. Oh, I hadn't. And I'm happy to shame them into it. But it's 100 and some pages. But I'm not going to read that at all. It says, the laws found in the Bible dwell on relationships, not only among individuals, but also with all other living beings. It says, you shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and withhold your help. If you chance to come upon a bird's nest or any tree in the ground with young ones or eggs and the mother sitting upon them, you shall not take the mother with the young. Sounds reasonable. I can remember years ago, I've been friends with Colin Standish for years, and I used to have a lot of arguments with him. And I remember years ago I was walking with him and I stomped on a few ants and he got quite stirred up. And I thought he's become Hindu or something. So we had a discussion and I finally saw what I'd studied with Albert Schweitzer. There's no great value in an ant, but if you are someone who gratuitously destroys an ant or a bush or a tree or the environment in any way that you could otherwise avoid, you set yourself against God. God is the life force. Do you want to be part of the destructive force? The Pope's picked up on this. And he says, along these same lines, rest on the seventh day is meant not only for human beings, but also so that your ox and your donkey may have rest, Exodus 23:12. Clearly, the Bible has no place for a tyrannical anthropocentrism and concern for other creatures. He's talking about the whole world for survival. And he says, disregard for the duty to cultivate and maintain a proper relationship with my neighbor, for whose care and custody I am responsible, ruins my relationship with my own self, with others, with God, and with the earth. That's the underlying logic. And here he goes further, talking about Noah and the wickedness of the earth. He says, nevertheless, through Noah, who remained innocent and just, God decided to open a path of salvation. In this way, he gave humanity the chance of a new beginning. The biblical tradition, listen to this, clearly shows that this renewal entails recovering and respecting the rhythms inscribed in nature by the hand of the Creator. We see this, for example, in the law of the Sabbath. On the seventh day, God rested from all his work. He commanded Israel to set aside each seventh day as a day of rest, a Sabbath, in all the texts. Similarly, every 7 years, a sabbatical year was set aside. Says finally, after 7 weeks of years, which is to say 49 years, the Jubilee was celebrated as a year of general forgiveness and liberty throughout the land for all its inhabitants. We're in, according to our Roman friends, the final Jubilee. They're acting on this assumption. Then a couple more quotes. And of course, you have to know where it goes wrong. It says, on Sunday, our participation in the Eucharist has special importance. Sunday, like the Jewish Sabbath, is meant to be a day which heals our relationships with God, with ourselves, with others, and with the world. And he says, Sunday is the day of the resurrection, the first day, in quotes, of the new creation, whose first fruits are the Lord's risen humanity, the pledge of the final transfiguration of all created reality. It also proclaims man's eternal rest in God, in quotes. In this way, Christian spirituality incorporates the value of relaxation and festivity. We tend to demean contemplative rest as unproductive and necessary, but this is to do away with the very thing which is most important about work, its meaning. And I'll shorten it a bit. He says, the law, this is the same paragraph, the law of weekly rest forbade work on the seventh day. Quote, so that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your maidservant and the stranger may be refreshed. Rest opens our eyes to the larger picture and gives us renewed sensitivity to the rights of others. This document's addressed to the whole world, not to Catholics, not to Christians, everybody. He's talking about universal human rights. And so, the day of rest, he continues, centered on the Eucharist, there's the twist, of course, sheds its light on the whole week and motivates us to greater concern for nature and the poor. And then it concludes a few paragraphs from the end. It says, even now, we are journeying toward the Sabbath of eternity, the New Jerusalem, toward our common home in heaven. I don't know how many of you remember that set piece that some Adventists did notice of Tony Palmer and Kenneth Copeland and the TV audience that were in a leadership conference, and Tony Palmer was the spoiler there, saying the Reformation was over, you're all Catholics now, and he popped his friend on the big screen, and here's the Pope in his private quarters, very nicely calling for all Christians to come together. Forget doctrine. Come back, like, as he said, like Joseph's brothers who were looking for food, but they found their brother. In other words, Protestants, you've wronged the good old Mother Church, but we'll accept you back. It was an interesting scene. And Tony Palmer, that double agent, because he was working for the Catholic Church and had worked for Kenneth Copeland, and then unfortunately was killed in a motorcycle accident. But Tony Palmer then said to that group, you need to work for the return of Christ. Remember, he says, it's now the Elijah message. Why aren't we, you and I, speaking of the Elijah message, a final call before the great and dreadful day of the Lord, before the horsemen clatter across the sky? It's about to happen. And I found out belatedly that even in advance of the Pope's speech, he sent an emissary to pressure Congress to put the family rest day on the legislative agenda. Obviously, even if they had, it wouldn't go through now. The fullness of time is not here. There is a little resistance even yet. But would there be a resistance if the Sears Towers went down? Would there be a resistance if the San Andreas Fault slipped and a tsunami swept in? Would there be a resistance if we had another 2008, as it's going to happen, because that was not the full collapse, even though we've put about $2 trillion of manufactured numbers on the bank's bottom lines. We are right at the precipice, and we need to proclaim the Lord's law, the law of liberty, and his soon return in a way that's coherent. Not that this is incoherent, but it's troubled because it diverts into a day that is even the Roman Catholic Church said very honestly in Dies Domini, that many Adventists seem to have read. It says there, while the early Christian Church, I've almost memorized the line, while the early Christian Church had no direct command from the Lord, they felt that they had the authority to change it. It is a matter of authority. And whether, you know, how directly that first a rider on the white horse, and I think very directly can be linked to Christ. It's the same imagery. How could it be the Antichrist? But there's no question that's a matter of authority. Why would mere man challenge such a claim? Interesting times that we live in. I don't want to read that again. I know that we're getting very close, although none of us know the time. We're not to set times. Ellen White says, no time prophecy after 1844. But I want to share something with you from Spurgeon, a preaching hero of mine, and I felt that I'd really let him down the other day. In a sermon, I mentioned that he was practicing his preaching in London around the year 1900. He was dead by then. He died, I think, 1893, but he was fairly parallel to the early days of the Adventist Church, a great and powerful Baptist preacher. This is what he said, obviously speaking about England, but in spite of, maniacal new worlders, the Western world generally has a pretty good idea of religious freedom, similar to what's in the US Constitution. And this is what he said. He said, now it is a great privilege that we enjoy civil and religious liberty in our favored land, that we are not under such cruel laws as in other times or in other countries laid restrictions upon conscience, and that we may pray according to the conviction of our judgment and the desire of our heart. But as I want you to value the privilege very much, and please follow his logic, he says, I will put a supposition to you. Suppose there was only one place in the world where a man might pray and offer his supplication to God. Well, I think there's not a man among us that would not like to get there at some time or another, or at least die there. Or what pains we would take to reach the locality. What pressure we would endure to enter the edifice. If there were only one house of prayer in all the world, and prayer could be heard nowhere else, what tugging and squeezing and toiling there would be to get to that one place. But now you may pray anywhere. People slight the exercise and neglect the privilege. He says, now that prayer is free, without money and without price, the poorest need not bring a farthing when he comes to have an audience with God. How it's neglected. Perhaps it would not be a bad thing on some accounts if there could be a law to prevent men from praying, because someone would say, we will pray. They would pray. They would get over the traces and stoutly protest, we are not to be kept down, we must pray. What would you do? This is really a far out there supposition. If there were martial law in the US and you were not to gather here this morning, would you pray? Would you worship? Very few people that I spoke of have even thought about the possibility, because they don't even think martial law. Well, not today, not tomorrow. It's not an unexpected thing. They are planning it because forward thinkers know what's coming. Men's hearts are failing them for what's coming upon the earth. And the first thing that comes to any martial or military law is a restriction on the right of assembly. Right now, since the Bush era, we have free speech zones behind a rope barricade, sometimes 3-4 miles from where the personage is. You realize that? It's already been made a mockery of. And a martial law will quickly make a mockery of the right of religious practice, unless you are of the acceptable group, unless, as the Pope says, you are free of extremism and fundamentalism. You think you are? It's all a matter of perspective. We really need to think carefully what we're going to do. I don't want to belabor because the time is over, so I'll end again with Spurgeon. Powerful. I'd love to have heard him preaching. This is what he said in a sermon on faith and life, because I think this is not just where we are, it's where we've been. You know, those periods of history, either church or Roman, that are alluded to in the progression of horsemen, are wrapped up in what he says there, right to the presence. This is what he said, present. There is nothing, he says, which my heart desires more than to see you, the members of this church, distinguished for holiness. Adventists have forgotten it, but we were part of the holiness movement. It wasn't just to make a big noise and a song and a dance about the soon return of Christ. It was to prepare ourselves and others for that. A holiness movement. And he says, It is the Christian's crown and glory. An unholy church? It is of no use to the world and of no esteem among men. Oh, it is an abomination. Hell's laughter, heaven's abhorrence. And the larger the church, the more influential, the worse nuisance does it become when it is dead and unholy. The worst evils that have ever come upon the world have been brought upon her by an unholy church. Whence came the darkness of the Dark Ages? From the Church of Rome. And if we want to see the world again sitting in Egyptian darkness, bound with fetters of iron, we have only to give up the faith and to renounce holiness of life. And we may drag the world down again to the limbo of superstition and bind her fast in chains of ignorance and vice. Oh, Christian, he said, the vows of God are upon you. You are God's priests. Act as such. You are God's king. Reign over your lusts. You are God's chosen. Do not associate with Belial. Heaven is your portion. Live like a heavenly spirit. So shall you prove that you have the true faith. That was the response of A.T. Jones and a critical element of the church back at the time when it appeared all about to happen. And we've drifted on happily, not so happily, arguing over many things. And I'll say it because it bothers me. I've told a couple of people at the headquarters there. There was a call for revival. It's about 6 years ago now. And it died on the altar of women's ordination. Not that there's anything wrong necessarily with women's ordination, but plenty wrong with the argument. We've been fighting among ourselves while the world is galloping toward a confrontation. I do hope and pray that we will open our eyes and see the issues for what they are. Little changed from the early days of the Christian church and its flirtation with an imperial power. And it likely will drift back into the same model as it did for our church and others in Hitler's Germany. Very sad story. As it will for some when an oppressive power rears its head again in our era, perhaps in our day directly. We don't know the day or the hour. But you would have to be asleep as an observant person and any understanding of history to know or to think that we're going to drift into another golden age. Everybody that's writing about these things knows that the world is undergoing rapid flux and that the Arab Spring, engineered as it likely was in part, is the harbinger of what Ellen White says will be a prevailing global situation before the return of Christ, when scenes like the French Revolution are all around the world. But those are precisely the times when we need to see the right man, capital M, on the white horse. We need to see, as Gehazi was able to see, the horsemen in the hills all around us, and by faith link to that power and stake our future in being there when the rescue comes. God bless you.